thanks very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I do want to begin with four quick advertisements, and then I need to respond to Tom equally on four small points. So the advertisements are, first, I am the chair of an organization of economists called Economists for Peace and Security, which you can find at www.epsusa.org. It is a member organization of the ASSA. We do sessions at the annual meetings and a variety of other activities that bring together economists who are concerned about particularly conflict and security issues, but also about a wider range of questions that have challenged the profession in the wake of the crisis. Secondly, for those of you who are working on difficult problems in ways which do not necessarily fit with the journal culture, I have become the editor of one editor of a journal you may not be familiar with, Structural Change and Economic Dynamics, a journal which works substantially in the tradition of Luigi Pazzanetti, but has a fairly eclectic reach as far as the articles and the kinds of things we're interested in. So I want to encourage you to have a look and to consider SCED as a venue for the work that you may be doing as it comes along. Thirdly, like Tom, I have a book which has been in existence for 2 days. It's called Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy before the Great Crisis. And Tom and I are practicing a kind of Hannibal-like can-I-pincer movement on all the major British presses. His is with Cambridge, mine is with Oxford. So we've got the territory completely covered. I do not have a copy to show you because only one copy is in existence and I already gave it to my wife. She said, "I will quote your mother, do I have to read it?" Fourth advertisement. Tom and I are both present in the latest issue of the Cambridge Journal of Economics, which is a very good collection on the question of austerity, and I just want to commend that to you. My talk is going to be based, in part, somewhat loosely, on a paper, a short comment that appears at the back of that journal called Austerity and Fraud Under Different Structures of Technology and Resource Abundance, and I'll leave a copy of that here should anybody be interested. Okay. Then the four points of response to Tom's remarks. First of all, there is a matter of character here. I want to say emphatically and unequivocally that my ski loyalties are right here. I come every year. I occasionally find Tom a lot, but I'm here every year, and I have a witness, Professor Blattenberger, who can attest to this fact. Secondly, a Hobson's choice is not, as Professor Paley said, a choice between bad and worse. It is a choice between the option offered and nothing at all.
Yes.
And Hobson is not, as you may imagine as economist, a reference to John A. Hobson, but rather to Thomas Hobson of the late 16th century, who was a livery stable owner in Cambridge, who offered his clients the choice between the horse that was closest to the door and no horse whatever. So you're forgiven,
no,
but don't do it again. Thirdly, I'm not a member, actually, I think, of any of Tom's groups, but of course I'm allied with the third one in a loose way. We do have a very strong agreement on the importance of unions. I'm going to state that at the outset. I also want to say that in the 1990s, when I did work for a number of years as the chief technical advisor to the State Planning Commission of the People's Republic of China on macroeconomic reform, one of the things I did was to bring the very distinguished labor economist Michael Reich from Berkeley to write a paper for them on the role that trade unions could play in China. And it's possible that that lay in the background of a legal reform that was enacted by the People's Assembly that had some opening toward trade unions. And it may not have been a terribly significant reform, but I have to say it was significant enough so that the American Chamber of Commerce in China was opposed to it and lobbied against it. Final point. The question of terminology that you raised at the end, I think, is still up in the air. And I would like to say that I would preserve the Krugman saltwater and freshwater dichotomy. I propose that we note that that exists, but that both saltwater and freshwater are substantially sterile, and that, in fact, the third alternative is what we might call the backwater. And that, as any biologist will tell you, is where all the evolution actually occurs. So I'm proud to be out here with my fellow backwater comments. I am putting this in print, by the way, so that... okay, I have entitled my talk, The Strange Short Keynesian Revival and What It Left Out. A few years ago at Columbia University, I attended a 60th birthday celebration honoring Joe Stiglitz, and there I had the privilege of hearing Bob Solow give a paper which was entitled Dumb and Dumber in Macroeconomics. It was an excoriating paper, wonderful to listen to, and I was sitting next to my Yale classmate of some years previously, a man by the name of Ernesto Zeguio, and I remarked to him that I've always thought that if only one could close one's eyes and ears for, say, 30 years, all this nonsense would go away. And he nodded and he said, yes, it was a very good time to go into public service. You're not laughing. He was president of Mexico, for God's sake. In the fall of 2007, Professor Marvin Goodfriend published an article in the Journal of Economic Perspectives that provides, I think, a very excellent summary of the state of mainstream macroeconomics at that point. It's entitled, How the World Came to Consensus on Monetary Policy. And it will rank, if justice is served, alongside Irving Fisher's classic summer 1929 comment that stocks have reached a permanently high plateau, amongst the memorable phrases of great economists. The thesis that Professor Goodfriend offered was that economic outcomes had started improving when central banks stopped responding to unemployment, concentrated their energies entirely on a target of inflation, and that the cost of reducing inflation at this particular turning point, which was, as Tom already mentioned, around 1980, which had been thought ex ante to be extremely high, proved to be much lower because central banks interjected the new element of transparency and credibility into their approach to the problem, communicating in an effective and forceful and non-refutable way their intention to maintain vigilance against inflation from that point forward, and that this was essentially the formula that gave us what the mainstream had termed the Great Moderation. This is a world with one hero, the independent central banker, advised, of course, from the near sidelines by the wise economist. However, if you read the article, it's very interesting. You have to read it carefully because the eye moves quickly over English prose and you say, maybe I should read that sentence once again. There is a telling qualification in the analysis. Good Goodfriend wrote that only 20 to 30% of the Great Moderation could be traced to monetary policy directly. The rest was due to two factors, what he called good luck in the form of more stable commodity prices after 1980, and what he called unexplained strength in residential and non-residential construction. In other words, 70 to 80% of the Great Moderation, even by the admission of one of its principal celebrants, is not attributable, at least not directly, to better monetary policy, but to events that might be, if one mentioned a few things that are not in fact brought in and named directly in the article, that might be traced to the debt crisis of the early 1980s, to the collapse of world oil prices in the mid-1980s, to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the flooding onto the world markets after that, of the commodities produced in that region or previously consumed in that region, to the rise of China as a supplier to world markets of very low cost wage goods. Matters which you might think have some broader significance, which were not addressed in the theory at all. And with respect to the second part of the qualification, there is the deregulation and desupervision of finance that led to the housing boom and ultimately to the bust. On this too, the article is silent. And the fact that the Federal Reserve, our independent central bank, is the lead regulator of the banking system goes unmentioned. Well, good luck on oil, which did hold from through the 80s and 90s, ran out in the late 2000s, and perhaps before that, for reasons that economists rarely reflect on, and so far as I know, have not really developed an authority to study or to pronounce on. Whether because of changing geophysical conditions, as some allege, or the desupervision of speculative markets and their effect on the ability, on the pricing power of the suppliers. These are obviously matters of vital interest, but you have to, I think, go quite far from the typical economics journal to learn anything about them, and to sources whose reliability you do not necessarily have a good picture of. Still, the Kolesky-Levy equation will tell you that when oil, a commodity of which we import approximately two-thirds of our supply, goes to $147 a barrel, you're going to have a profits problem. You're going to have a stress on the previously functioning system. And then, of course, the banking system melted down. Confidence collapsed, and it collapsed following what is documentably the greatest wave of financial fraud and the largest failure of regulation and financial supervision in recorded history. A failure committed in part by the very same central bankers who, as late as 2007, the end of 2007, after the meltdown was in fact underway, surfaced visibly when the interbank lending markets froze in August of 2007, were still being celebrated as the heroes of the age, and who, I think as late as the middle of 2008, were still publicly expressing their confidence that the problems of housing finance were modest and could be contained. Something which I think we now know they did not believe in part. A fact which ought at least to weigh upon the credibility that these figures apparently prize and on which their reputation for effective policymaking has come to rest. Did fraud really lie at the foundation of the meltdown? I think this fact is documented now very effectively in a number of books. I would recommend to you, if you haven't read it, the book by Kathleen Ingle and Patricia McCoy called The Subprime Virus. In histories by journalists, notably, well, Matt Taibbi is always great to read, but there's also Joe Nocera and Bethany McLean, All the Devils Are Here. There's a passage in that book, which I think captures things quite vividly, in which he describes how the company AmeriQuest, a mortgage originator, perhaps the largest one, made a practice of providing its loan officers with crystal methamphetamine to improve their performance on the job. I remarked on this to a colleague at a conference in Europe, and she said, that's a rape drug. I said, yes, exactly, that's the point. There are also studies, even by ratings agencies. In 2007, Fitch Ratings conducted a little survey, a little digging into the documentation underlying a number of residential mortgage-backed securities, and discovered, they said, quite surprisingly, that there was fraud, abuse, or missing documentation in virtually every file. That's a quote. And then there are official investigations and reports. I highly recommend the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's report, a really remarkable piece of public service. The multiple reports of the Congressional Oversight Panel, chaired by Elizabeth Warren and vice-chaired by Damon Silverson. The Senate Permanent Investigations Committee, the Carl Levin reports, and the reports of Neil Marshofsky, the Special Inspector General for the TARP program. Massive documentation is available for anybody who wishes to look for it. But it's also illuminated by simple matters of language. In the industry, a class of loans which was formerly called Alt-A loans were known as liar's loans. Loans with teaser rates that were set to reset, that were being offered to people already at the limit of their capacity to pay, who would never be able to repay once the loans reset. These were called neutron loans. It's from the nuclear lexicon. It means that when they explode, the people will be destroyed, but the buildings will still be there. The equity tranche of a residential mortgage-backed security package, which was retained by the lender, was called toxic waste. Okay, if you go to a restaurant and you discover that the wait staff are referring to the food as scum, sewage, and sludge, you will probably come to the conclusion that they are aware that the business that they're in is not 100% honest. Okay? That's what we're looking at. Language, I think, also can help us to frame a much clearer understanding of what this industry had become. Millions of mortgages, of documents, were issued to people that were called mortgages. But they didn't have any of the properties that we traditionally associate with mortgages. They were not issued to people who had documented their loans, their incomes, who had credit histories that could sustain the payment, against houses that had been appraised fairly. They were issued against houses that had been, where their appraisals had been exaggerated in order to make the loan go through. These were not mortgages. These were counterfeit mortgages. This was a counterfeiting ring, properly spoken. And when you have a large counterfeiting ring, mostly in the private sector, mostly beyond the direct reach of regulators, set up that way, Countrywide, AmeriQuest, and so forth, but also many that were supposed to be regulated and were not, Indie Mac, WAMU, and so forth. When you have a counterfeiting ring, the counterfeits need to be presented as authentic to the formal market. This is called laundering in the trade related to the financing of export-import of controlled substances. Okay? Laundering. I love the French word, blanchissage. Yes. Who did that? That was the job of the ratings agencies. They took mortgages that they, if they had inspected the documentation, they would have known were going to default, did not inspect the documentation and then concocted reasons to present mixed up packages of these things to the market as though they were AAA, comparable to United States government securities. Then these things have to be sold. And purveyors of contraband know that, have a word for this, it's called fencing. Right? Fencing is something that was done by the commercial and the investment banks. And to whom? There's a word for that too, it's called the mark. If you read Michael Lewis's wonderful book, The Big Short, you will find a dialogue about that, in which someone says, so who's buying this stuff? And the answer comes back, Dusseldorf. Which happened to be the headquarters of a major German bank, IKB, which was one of the first to fail when the crisis broke. Why? Because it had, in fact, been buying. But it's also a metaphor for a larger cultural phenomenon and reminds us that the financial crisis that was engendered here is not simply restricted to the US, but it's also the European crisis. What happened there to sovereign loans was a reaction by the investor community when they realized they were taking massive losses on the toxic securities supplied to them by the American banks. You will find, as I say, ample discussion of this all through the legal and journalistic literature. You will not find it in the economic literature to any substantial degree. And if you go to a conference hosted by the IMF or some other reputable agency, and I've tried this, and raise the subject, you will be not entirely shut out, but politely left to one side and not engaged. Two reasons, I think. First, to acknowledge the pervasive character of fraud underlying the system is to acknowledge that the markets are not dealing in a standard commodity which can be priced in a standard way. So to acknowledge that the whole pricing formulas markets are completely worthless. And it's also to acknowledge that the previous period of growth was actually based upon an illegitimate and destructive process, which raises questions not only about the crisis, but about the prior policy intent and the legitimacy of the people who set up the system to fail in this way. And so I think it's understandable that economists and policymakers are much more comfortable using the term bubble, which you hear all the time. Bubble acknowledges that things are unstable, but it gives us a detached view of the instability. And bubbles are, they grow slowly, they collapse quickly. But when they collapse, where are you? You're right back where you started. Bubbles intrinsically do not do harm. Right? And there's something sort of childish about them, too. They're fascinating and pretty and so on. The whole language that we have already accustoming ourselves to use to describe this process gives it an aura of innocence that it does not deserve. Well, why was fraud tolerated in this particular period and not before? And I can go through and give you the instances of how the desupervision occurred so that the way was cleared for fraud. There's an ample literature on that. Why now and why not earlier? I think the two things I've just mentioned are closely linked. In a period where you have, for better or for worse, strong profitability, the capacity to extract surplus from the functioning of the productive system, fraud tends not to be tolerated. Laws tend to be rigorously enforced, and people make money anyway, because the people who are making money in an honest way have an interest in policing the system. When it becomes more difficult, and the system still maintains and needs to maintain an illusion of growth, then the incentives change, and you get pressure on the political system to be much more tolerant than it ever was before. And I think we've lived through that, and I'm not sure we've come to grips with it as an analytical matter. Then the crash came. And we are now beginning to have, I think, some very interesting and illuminating historical records on that. Material from Ryan Litza in the New Yorker, along with the documentation of the memoranda prepared in the Obama White House in the early part of 2009. Ron Suskind's very interesting book, Confidence Men, and Noam Schieber's new book, which I have read about but not yet got my hands on, called Escape Artists, which tell us quite a bit about exactly how economists in power reacted both in their forecasts and their prescriptions to the events that they had to confront, some things that were known previously and some that were not so well known. We know that the immediate response to the, in particular, to the crisis, was prompted by a Keynesian instinct, but conditioned by an unchanged anti-Keynesian forecasting method and general set of attitudes in which a mean reversion to a natural rate of unemployment over 5 years or so was built into both the formal models and the informal thinking from the beginning, and actually handed off by the outgoing Office of Management and Budget in the Bush administration to the incoming officials in the Obama administration. The forecasting exercise had to be done in December of 2008. To this, there was married a loanable funds theory of the interest rate that helped to generate the fear that large deficits in the future would have catastrophic financial consequences, a hysteria that we have been living with for the last several years, and also some mechanical notions about what the normal nominal interest rates actually are, which are built into the forecast, and which together with this mean reversion for nominal GDP, inflation and employment, combine to give the very scary projection that the debt to GDP ratio would rise to triple any past historical level over the next 15 or so years. And to this sort of witch's brew of half-baked and ill-thought-through ideas, we have to add the ad hoc tendency of certain economists to overrate their own political skills, and the fact that 10 to the 12th is really a very big and scary number. Extraplanetary was the term that Professor Summers used to Professor Romer in the privacy of the White House to describe his reaction to her estimates of the GDP gap. So that no program actually meeting the output gap could even be proposed, let alone implemented, and also so that the proposed duration of intervention was necessarily accepted to be short. Thus, from the very beginning, the policy discussion was infected with this awful term stimulus, which again conditioned us to believe that we were dealing with a fundamentally healthy organism which only needed an injection, you think adrenaline or caffeine or methamphetamine for that matter, in order to get it moving again. Right? This is not a prescription that you would use if you were facing organ failure. Right? If what you need is a transplant, a cup of coffee isn't going to do the job. Alright? I mean, just think about the metaphorical structure and how many times even people on the progressive side have reflexively used that term stimulus, which I try to reject every time I hear it. And meanwhile, the forecasts continued to be optimistic, leavened with memorable phrases like green shoots, and the notion that the government's intervention could be temporary because the real objective of policy was to get the flow of credit going again, as though the relationship between the bank and the population is a plumbing relationship with a pipe that you just need to unjam by putting enough money into the pump. Right? Again, something nobody who knows anything about banking would accept as a plausible description of a credit contract. And that was 2 years ago. And while the economy did stabilize for reasons that I think we all understand, thanks in part to the effective insurance schemes, in part to the nationalization of shaky credit markets, and in part to automatic stabilizers in the fiscal channel, it did not recover and has not recovered. And though for the moment the news is again good, it's obviously not going to recover, and there is no way that the 16 million people who have lost jobs, particularly older ones, are ever going to be reemployed before they hit retirement age. It's just not going to happen, and we recognize this in our lives, but we do not yet recognize it in our public dialogue. For any public leader, this should have been an object lesson in the reality that your economic advisors do not have the same objective function as yourself. They would rather go down in defeat and return to their banks, their hedge funds, and their universities than admit to a flaw in their worldview. Let's say, political leaders, I think, learned long ago that there was a problem of this kind with high-ranking military officials. Anybody who knows the Kennedy administration knows this is true. And actually, Richard Nixon said of his economists, often wrong, but never in doubt. Why this lesson continually has to be relearned by new generations of politicians is another mystery that we should explore. The result, in any event, was a failure. A failure in political terms and a disappointment in economic terms. Uncannily similar, and this subject has already come up earlier today, to the Keynesian experience of the 1960s. What happened there? Recall that in those years, the self-described Keynesians, the American version implants of the British tradition, tried to marry the general theory to neoclassical general equilibrium analysis, the Hicks-Hansen ISLM model, and then to graft onto that something called the Phillips curve, which lacked any clear theoretical basis. You will not find it in Keynes, but was cooked up by very primitive curve fitting to project the views of this particular group into the policy arena in a way that was straightforward and persuasive. And all of this was in the name of Keynes, who at that point was still considered to be a reputable figure. Well, what have we seen? An application, just now, of the same mental habits emerging from the same place, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and to a substantial degree from the same biological family. And that the perpetrator on this occasion is the nephew of the perpetrator on the previous one. And meanwhile, actual Keynesians, and I count myself in that group, grouse from the sidelines. And the consequence is also the same, which is that the doctrine does not yield satisfactory results. Its predictions prove to be false in a very short period of time. Actually, 69 to 71 was all it took for the Phillips curve to go on the ropes, the short-run trade-off idea. And it only took a couple of years, even less, for the notion that stimulus and green shoots would take hold for an even broader concept, an effective fiscal policy, to become widely discredited, not only by economists, but in the popular imagination. Right? And what happens? What happens in consequence? You get the rise of crackpot theories from which we will suffer for decades. In the previous example, the natural rate of unemployment, also known as the NIRU, the micro foundations for macroeconomics, rational expectations, all of that. It took us many years before, at the end of 2000, people said, oh, well, I guess it is possible to have full employment without inflation. And for 3 solid years, and the natural rate of unemployment sort of faded away. Today, it's the notion that fiscal consolidation is the only available strategy, and that expansionary austerity will lead us out of the crisis in Europe, in the UK, and with considerable reluctance in the United States. And I say the one redeeming feature that we have in this country is that we do hold elections for 100% of the membership of the House of Representatives every 2 years. But for us economists who are observing this with some distance, it is a deadly temptation to get involved in these debates and devote yourself to them. And that's a little bit like the moth being attracted to the flame. It is a complete distraction from the kinds of issues that we should be concerned with. I think there were already and will continue to be many well-justified criticisms directed at the neoliberal doctrine, and Tom's criticisms, largely I subscribe to them. But not enough has been directed to the false Keynesians who assert themselves as the so-called counterweight, or even in some cases at the progressive side of the debate, sidle up to us and act as our friends in conditions of extremis. And there is a serious danger that the Keynesian position will again be hijacked and caricatured and simplified, and in this case that the argument will be simply that the stimulus should have been bigger, and if it had been, everybody would be all right. We see that argument being made prominently and not so prominently from the center to the center left of the spectrum. My view is that is not the position Keynes would have taken. Neither the Keynes of 1930, the author of the essay on the consequence of the slump for the banks, nor the Keynes of 1940, the author of How to Pay for the War. That Keynes was acutely aware of both the centrality of the financial infrastructure, the value of collateral and bankers' margins to the functioning of the system, and to the threat of costs to inflation and the macroeconomic consequences of cost-driven inflation, which we have totally left to one side, exogenized, and refused to come to grips with. So what's left out? In my view, two things have been left out: science and law. On the science side, I do not pretend to be an expert, in part because, as a defect of training and distraction over many years, I developed the expertise or authority that I need. But it seems to me that the problem of oil, of commodities, of energy generally, the potential for repeated shocks, the expectation that those shocks are likely to occur, the increase in uncertainty that's associated with that, and that inevitable Kolesky-Levy equation of determination of profits gives us a very real risk of living with a choke chain effect, such that every time we push a stimulus package, we get hit with a cost shock, as some other force has an ability to act in a predatory way on the growth of the system. And until we come to grips with that openly and directly and effectively, I am very skeptical about the prospect that naive Keynesianism can retrieve the situation. So I think if we're not dealing with energy, and incidentally also with climate, maybe not incidentally, then we as economists are not engaging with the issues we need to engage with. And secondly, there's the question about financial fraud and its ongoing implications, which seem to me raise two important questions. One of them is the scale of the financial sector, which we have preserved in the reaction to the crisis, quite deliberately, allowing the biggest banks to get bigger, to come to an even greater domination of financial markets, even though the one thing they are not doing is providing credit to the rest of the economy. These are institutions that are large in relation to the flow of profits. At the peak, they were earning 40% of all corporate profits, and maybe even more, actually, in 2010. I would suggest to you that is a very large fixed cost for any economy under stress to bear to allow for profitability in the rest of the private economy, which we ought to be concerned about if we're concerned about real living standards and the general shared prosperity. As an accounting matter, reducing the size of the sector ought to be a very important policy goal. Secondly, there is a question about whether confidence can ever be restored in the existing structure of financial institutions. And here I think we need to rethink the way we have approached, as economists, over my entire lifetime, the problem of regulation, which we have unwittingly adopted the Murray-Wiedenbaum approach of the early, of the late 1970s, before he went to the Reagan White House, in which we treat regulation as a cost and benefit matter of interference in the private market, sometimes for a good purpose, but always with reservations. And I would say to you, no, we are misconceiving the problem here. In a complex modern economy, regulation is the foundation of an effective market, because the consumer will not trust to the market process unless they are confident that there is a regulatory authority doing the work that the consumer cannot possibly do themselves. You won't buy lettuce if you don't think someone's keeping the E. coli out of it. Right? I like this example because one can observe the counterfactual in China, where no one has that confidence, and you can't buy lettuce, and certainly nobody would leave it uncooked on a table, except there is an exception. I know because my sister-in-law manages supermarkets in China. Right? You can get lettuce in China from Sam's Club. Straight from California and certified by the United States Department of Agriculture, and the Chinese customer knows that that's good lettuce. Okay. Electrical appliances, you're not going to plug them in unless you can know that they're not going to burn up. And banks, you're not going to trust them unless you have a scheme which tells you that the securities that they're peddling you have some intrinsic honesty to them. So one has to ask, in a world in which one has digitized and diversified financial instruments to the extent that we have done so, using computers to make them almost completely opaque and impenetrable, whether it's in fact technically possible to restore the financial system that existed 15, 20 years ago. I think that is a question, it's a question to which I don't have an answer, but it's a question toward which economists should be directing their attention. This is not the first time that the financial sector collapsed. It happened in 1929 to 1933. The number of banks was reduced by about a third, and an enormous new regulatory structure was imposed. Did the banking system recover? No. It most certainly did not. It was stabilized. But all of the growth that we got in the 1930s was government programs, and all of the growth we got in the 1940s was the war. None of it was the private banking system per se as a leading force. That didn't start happening until the highly regulated system of the 50s and 60s had its chance. And the banks did not get a leading role until the middle 1970s. The early middle 1970s. So you can count 40 or 50 years under the previous technological regime, from financial crash to financially driven expansion. And that's a technological regime which is much simpler than the one we're dealing with now. So I just want to suggest to you that those two issues, for people who are interested in the Keynesian paradigm, are things that we either address, that we must address, if we're going to be reality-based economists. Thanks very much.